Okay, it's just after 5 o'clock, and I'm really pleased to welcome people joining in. The numbers are growing, and welcoming everyone into this June BIPs webinar, where we're delighted to be joined by Rudy Mattei. And while people join in and get online, I'll just run through a couple of slides to give you a bit of information. So, in case you're not familiar with BIPs, with the British Institute for Persian Studies, and maybe you've just heard about us through seeing this particular talk advertised, but we have lots of events. We have monthly webinars and some in-person lectures coming up later in the year as well. And the next webinar will be happening at the end of July, on the 29th of July, again at 5 p.m. on Zoom. And that's going to be given by Leila Rahimi Bahmani. And it will be on the topic of literature in the service of monolingualism, Turkophobia in modernist Persian poetry. So that promises to be really interesting. So please do join us. And of course, on YouTube, we have a channel that has an archive of lots of our past talks. And indeed, this talk that Rudy's giving us today will be posted later on onto the YouTube channel. And the other thing I wanted to tell you about is please do become a BIPs member. It's wonderful to be part of the BIPs community. But another advantage that you get if you join BIPs, as well as just getting all of that information and being on the mailing list and receiving the Iran Journal, which are all great things in themselves. But another thing is you get the advantage of being eligible to apply for travel research and research assistant grants. And we'll be opening up our next round of grant, the grant window, grant application window tomorrow, and that will be open until the 11th of September. So you can have the summer to put your ideas together, and please do put in an application. And if you want to just make sure that you don't ever miss out on any of our talks or any of our events, you can follow us on Facebook, X, Instagram, and then our YouTube channel is there, and we're on LinkedIn as well. And also, we have a web page there, which you can see the address of. And just to remind everyone, we're funded by the UK government, and we have strict just sort of events policies. So that's our policy. Just when you're asking questions, we kind of avoid overtly, I guess, politicizing political debate and a discussion, but being inclusive, of course, and just asking Rudy about his work is really going to be welcomed, and you'll have that chance to ask questions once Rudy's talked us through his work. So if we just, yeah, so the title today is Mehmandari: Hosting and Minding Foreign Visitors in Safavid and Qajar, Iran. And I'll just tell you a bit about who our esteemed speaker is. Rudy has a PhD from UCLA, and before that he studied in the Netherlands. And he's the John and Dorothy Munro Distinguished Professor of Middle East History at the University of Delaware. So he's joining us from there. He's got loads of really interesting books. I really recommend that you check out his work. And this presentation that he's going to be giving us and talking us through today is from an article that's published. So you can search that up. And if you're interested, go and have a read and read the full thing after the talk. But I'll hide myself now, and we'll hand over to Rudy. And thank you very, very much for joining us today, Rudy.
Thank you so much, Eva Leila, and thanks to BIPs for inviting me. It's an honor and a pleasure. Also, thanks to Maria Rabbani and everyone else who's been involved in organizing this. And of course, to all the attendees, all of whom remain anonymous to me to the extent that I know you. A warm welcome. Let me apologize for the fact that I don't have a PowerPoint. I don't have any kind of visual material relevant to the talk. So you'll have to just deal with my talking head, so to speak. So let me start with the centrality in Persian, Islamic, Iranian Islamic culture of the idea of the mehman, of the guest, and mehman nawazi, hospitality, treating guests well. because it is very central, you know, and not just in Iranian, but in Islamic culture, of course. It begins, of course, with this idea that the guest comes from afar, and they were typically dealing with inhospitable environments, harsh, desert, arid-like, and so forth, where receiving a guest, accommodating him, and it's typically him, of course, so allow me for using that gendered pronoun for the remainder of the talk, and accommodate him safely and take care of him because it's a matter of life or death. So it's the idea that, you know, the person you receive today, accommodating your tent, you feed him, you may kill him tomorrow if he's on equal standing with you in a different type of interaction. The guest is, of course, also inviolable because he brings news from far, from beyond the horizon, in a world which where communication beyond kith and kin is sporadic and intermittent. He informs the community about conditions in strange lands. And then, of course, ultimately, the guest also represents foreign powers, friends, and foes. In other words, he's an inherent part of diplomacy. And so he's a visitor deserving of respect and proper treatment. All the more so, I would argue, in the finely calibrated Iranian code of impersonal conduct. I think that that plays a role as well. I don't bring that out in the article, but I would like to add that. It's a bit of an intangible element, but it's not unimportant, I think. Now, of course, receiving guests is inherent in diplomacy. And then, you know, diplomacy, of course, has been treated in scholarship, in Iran scholarship. But the mehman and the guest, mehmandari, treating guests, has received very little attention. Most of the focus in diplomacy has been on limited themes, such as things, gift-giving, you know, concept of pishkesh. Lambton has an interesting article about it. I've talked about it, Encyclopedia Iranica, my contribution to gift-giving in the Safavid period. There has been work on the khalat, the robe of honor, which is typically part of the sort of goodbye presents to high-standing visitors. Nice book came out, Sinem Arja Kasale, Gifts in the Age of Empire, 2 years ago. But that's about it. And again, mehmandari has received almost no attention. And I'm trying to fill the gap, at least in part, by writing this article that's now available in First View in the journal Iran and by talking about it today. So I will be talking about mehmandar, the official appointed to welcome and accompany foreign guests, that is high caliber guests, taking care of their needs, ensuring their well-being, their comfort, and so forth. I will present this in four parts. First of all, I will talk a little bit about origins. Then I will have a part about his tasks and responsibilities. Then I will talk about the nature of the job, hospitality, but also the element of surveillance, very important and not necessarily apparent in the Persian sources. And thirdly, developments over time, because the office is in place really until the late Qajar period and then becomes very diffuse and seems to fade, but it's not terribly clear what happens to it. And that was number four. And of course, the focus will be on the Safavid and the Qajar period, as indicated in the title. Now, the mehmandar and mehmandari has a very long tradition in Middle Eastern history, precedes Islam by about a millennium, as far as we can tell, because it was an office in the Achaemenid period, so 500 BC, a function called the barishmada. Dan Potts has an interesting article that came out last year about that particular aspect of mehmandari. Came a bit too late for me to integrate it into my article, but I mention it. So I didn't really know about it. I hadn't gone that far back, and I'm not a specialist anyway. But anyway, the barishma, that was a professional guide to escorted foreign visitors. The Romans, too, had an official called Magister Officiorum, who was tasked with the same kind of responsibility. It seems to have existed in the Sasanian period, even though we have very few details about even the terminology. it seems that it's an offer seems to go back, it seems to have an Eastern origin, an Iranian writ large, Iranian origin, and it seems to have moved from East to West. Hence the Romans, the Byzantines seem to have vectors there. We find it in the Mamluk periods in the Arab world, same terminology, Mihmandari, of the Mihmandar. It continues in the Iranian tradition, even though until the Safavid period, we have very little documentation about it. A rare occurrence is in the Timurid period. We have the famous Spanish representative, Ruy González de Clavijo, who in 1402 and 3, I think, visits the court of Timur in Central Asia, and he reports about some kind of system involving the supply of fodder, horses, provided to foreign representatives. But it's a snippet, and not much more than that. So it really is the Safavid period in which we have the first proper documentation and frequent documentation. And that's in part, or mostly, I would even argue, because the foreigners visiting Iran, whose number, of course, goes up dramatically, begin to report about this because they experience it themselves firsthand. We have some information in the Persian sources, but it's by no means as informative as what comes out of the foreign sources. And that's, of course, not unique. Now, there's a claim of uniqueness about the system, and it comes from this French botanist, very important fellow, Joseph Piton de Tournefort, who visits Iran in 1701, 1702. That is the northwestern part. He travels mostly in the Ottoman Empire, you know, the Greek islands, and then the Black Sea coast, and then he ends up in Armenia and Georgia and so forth. And he argues that the office of Mehmandari is uniquely Iranian. Now, his reporting has to be taken seriously because he traveled widely in the Ottoman Empire. So if it was as prominent in the Ottoman Empire as in Iran, he wouldn't have said that. But he's still wrong, I think, or it's demonstrably wrong what he says, because it office did exist in the Ottoman Empire, even though it's not as prominently visible. It was not necessarily a standing office, and we have different terminology. We have the teşrif saçı, so the sort of the guy who deals with protocol, teşrifat in Persian. Or the Kapıçı Başı is another term used in the Ottoman Empire. So the terminology is a little different. But the task and the responsibility is pretty much the same. It's an official who's assigned to attend to the foreign visitor, takes care of his comfort, daily allowance, tayin is a term, is involved. And there are many examples of that that I give in my article. No point in repeating them here. Not necessarily a highly placed official, and not necessarily a standing office, but definitely the institution does exist. And we have the same in the Mughal period. Very little information. Also, different terminology. Ahadi is used, but it is true that in Safavid period it is ubiquitous and more lavish in the treatment of foreigners than in the Ottoman period. So Tournefort was not totally wrong in that sense. It is unique in its elaborate nature, if you want to call it that, and in the amount of money available and the attention given to the foreign the visitor. In the Persian sources, it occurs, but in mostly formulaic and somewhat idealized terms, mostly seen as a manifestation of the Shah's magnificence and munificence, little else in terms of analysis and detailed information about the task, and certainly nothing about changes in the office. It's poorly represented even in the three manuals from the late Safavid period that have come to us. Of course, the Tazkirat al-Muluk, the most famous one, the Dastur al-Muluk, and the Al-Qabu Mab'ujib Duri Safaviyyeh. Only one, I think, names the official. So even in that, in the official parlance, it's unclear whether it's a standing office, and it's certainly not clear what his tasks and responsibilities were. So that we have to get from the foreign sources. Now, it's clear that Mehmet Darib was not did not simply exist for foreign visitors. It was also applied to domestic high-ranking officials visiting the court. And again, I give some examples of that. But again, most of the attention is given to the foreign visitors because the source is mostly these same foreign visitors. That is the sources that have come to us. Now, what was the task of the Mehmandar? He was responsible basically for the well-being of the foreign visitor from the moment he arrived at the border until his time of departure from Iranian soil, which involved food, accommodation, and a per diem, you know, a certain amount of money per person spread out, or per day spread out over the entirety of the duration of the visit. Now, the practice in that sense, the logistics varied. You know, sometimes we have one mehmandar who receives a foreign visitor at the border, the first border town, and then accompanies him and his entourage all the way to the capital. But more typical, we have a succession. So we have a mehmandar who receives the foreigner at the border and then takes him to the first provincial town. And then we have a switch representative appointed by the ruler, the governor of the provincial town, appointing his own mehmandar. And then he's taken to the capital. And then typically Isfahan, being the capital, of course, of the 17th century, and that's where most of the information comes from. From the moment the foreigner arrives at the suburb of Tehran, Tokshi in the north and Isfahanek in the south, again, there is a change of guard, meaning that the Mehmandar Bashi, the head of the Mehmandars, appointed by the court itself, takes over and then becomes responsible for the well-being and the proper treatment of the foreign envoy. Now, so the Mehmandar Bashi is a standing position, even though, again, it's not that clear from the sources, the Persian sources, that is. The position is oftentimes combined with that of the Nazir Buyutat, the head of the Shah's household. But it's not clear if that's an institutionalized or simply sort of a habitual combination. From the moment the guest arrives in Isfahan, from the moment he leaves, which sometimes takes a year and a half, 2 years, depending on circumstances, it's the Mehmandar Bashi who acts as a liaison between the foreign guest, the visitor, and the court. He relays messages back and forth. He mediates in case of misunderstandings and conflicts regarding diplomatic protocol, all of which is very important because protocol is, of course, everything in East and West. That's not simply an Iranian thing. You know, finely calibrated in terms of perceived standing and importance of the respective courts and rulers. Now, who was appointed as Mehmandar? We get a variety of scenarios with regard to foreign visitors. Certainly Western ones, they typically had people, officials appointed, assigned to them according to personal taste, cultural experience, and linguistic ability. In other words, we oftentimes see Armenians and Georgians appointed to Westerners who like to drink wine, just like Armenians allowed to drink wine. There was a certain, you know, cultural affinity, of course, between the two in terms of religion and habits and so forth, outlook on life. There's also mostly in the 19th century the idea of experience with foreign ways and sometimes even having stayed in the West, not so much during the Safavid period because very few Iranians ended up living in the West and then coming back. But in the Qajar period, we see this, and those are typically appointed, oftentimes knowing French to the position of Mehmandar. Now, even more important than taste and cultural affinity was, of course, ranking. The Safavids appointed Mehmandars mostly according to perceived rank and standing. And that means that Muslim visitors, those from the Ottoman Empire, the Mughal Empire, and even the Uzbeks, who are ranked quite low in the pecking order within the Islamic world, tended to have a higher mihmandar appointed to them than Western visitors. Just as, you know, you look at the sources, Iran, the Persian language sources, to the extent that attention is paid to foreign visitors, diplomatic ones, the ones from the Ottoman Empire and Mughal India get far more play, far more attention paid to them than Westerners, who at best, if they're mentioned at all, get a line or two attached to them. So, but even these Western visitors are generously treated. Again, sort of reinforcing this notion expressed by Piton Tournefort that the Westerners, that the institution is unique in the Ottoman period in terms of accommodation. They get horses and mules supplied to them, tents, accommodation, victuals, provisions, and of course, a per diem, which is quite generous. And of course, the level of per diem depended, again, on the perceived rank of the visitor. So it varies quite a bit. And again, you know, as I already mentioned, Muslim visitors are more generously rewarded. But in the 19th century, we do see a shift. There are a couple of examples that I identify in the sources whereby the Russians and the British begin to be highly, you know, more highly valued, having to do with, of course, and sort of demonstrable greater importance in terms of the balance of power. So that's an interesting change. So all that is about hospitality and fantastic treatment and very attractive way of dealing with foreigners and so forth. But of course, mehmandari was not simply about hospitality and generosity. There was a downside to it. First of all, it had everything to do with surveillance. And then the mehmandar was also clearly a minder. And mehmandari, as I point out, was also something like a racket, providing lots of opportunities for people to engage in graft, profit from it, abuse the system, both Iranians and foreigners, by the way. Now, some visitors didn't see this downside. They just sort of wallowed in the generosity and they exulted in the generosity of Iranians, luxuriated in the generous treatment. But the more perceptive ones did notice. And they are quite open about it and describe it in some detail. First of all, naturally, you could argue, the movements of the foreign visitor were carefully monitored. Certainly the moment he was received in Isfahan. He was interrogated about his background, the origins of his travel, the intentions, how long he was going to stay, his, you know, marital status, all kinds of questions he was peppered with. And, you know, a natural impulse, of course, you know, you're curious about something that comes from abroad, but also definitely meant to register, record what this foreign visitor was all about. And again, there's nothing unusual about it because, of course, spying, if you want to use that term, has always been an integral element of diplomacy in the past, in past and in the present, and in East and West. And quarantining foreign visitors was not limited to Iran. We have the same in Venice. You know, foreigners were housed in a particular part of town, in a particular building, so they could be controlled. Now, perhaps Chardin's remark, who says that, well, Iranians simply didn't understand why anyone would travel 3,000 miles just for the heck of it to slake his own curiosity. They wouldn't buy that. There was always, you know, an ultimate motive behind it. The Pushtipardeh notion may have, you know, exacerbated or intensified this inherent suspiciousness. But again, you know, spying, finding out what the real reason is for the visitor's visit, especially if he's a diplomat, of course, is a natural impulse, you could argue. And that was definitely a part of the whole thing. So mehmandari then becomes a double-edged sword in my view, because he's swaddled, that is, the foreign visitor is swaddled in kindness and generosity. but he also becomes beholden that way. There's a price attached to it, even literally so, as I will point out. It begins with gifts, you know, very important part of diplomatic traffic, reciprocal gifts, again, commensurate with the perceived importance and status of the recipient, but also of the giver. It's kind of a high-level dance. Gifts are even counted for value and recorded as such. The mehmandar gets 10% of the perceived value of the gift, so money is involved right there. It also meant more generally that mehmandari laid claim on the visitor, made him beholden to the court. You know, you get a big gift and a very generous allowance, and it comes at a price. You know, it comes at, with some obligations. It's very hard to reject it. It was not easy to do that. There are foreigners who argue that in order not to get sort of involved in an inextricable net of obligations and counter obligations, basically say no. But that's not an easy option because at the very least, it means to a very awkward situation. And often and very easily and quickly, it means offensive behavior, you know, offensive to Iranian sensibilities. So that's an eternal dilemma. And there are some people who try to get around that by only accepting part of their per diem, only at the end of their visit, and so forth. But it remains a very touchy subject. Now, as importantly, mehmandari opens up all kinds of avenues for abuse. Most importantly, the generosity lavished on the foreign visitor or the visitor in general, high-ranking visitor, is extracting from the villagers. It's a burden on the people because all these victuals, all these provisions are really extorted from the local populace. They're fleeced and they have no way out other than flee. Excuse me. They are forced to come up with enormous amounts of provisions, you know, livestock, chickens, eggs, and so forth. And the price is harsh punishment, physical punishment in case of protests and rejections. In other words, villagers universally dreaded visitors, both domestic and foreign ones, and tended to flee. There are reports that the most prosperous villages in Iran existed not on the main roads, but aside in the countryside, unvisited by officials. Now, mehmandari was also open to abuse of a different type because the mehmandar had all kinds of opportunities to fill his own pocket with the money extracted from the villagers. You know, withholding part of it, not being open about the level of tayin, of the per diem. He also had to, there was a chain of command. He wasn't his own man. Of course, he was part of a larger system. He also had to report to his superiors, who themselves were oftentimes on the take. So he would be secretive about the amount of money involved and so forth. So there are all kinds of, there's all kinds of funny business going on, much of which, of course, unrecorded. And it's therefore not surprising that mehmandari was a very lucrative position and actually sold by auction, because it offered so much, so many opportunities for peculation. Now, the visitors themselves were also took advantage of the system. It's very interesting, mostly by way of impersonation. A lot of travelers to Iran, especially from Russia, but not simply from Russia, were basically merchants in the guise of high-level diplomats and presented themselves as diplomats, even though they just brought merchandise. In the hopes of being lavishly treated as such. And there was some acrimony about that. Imam Quli Khan, the famous governor of Fars and most of southern Iran in the period, the late period of Shah Abbas and into the period of Safi I, actually suggested destroying Persepolis so as to remove at least one attractive monument frequently visited by all these foreigners in order to limit the number of these sort of imposters coming to Iran. So that's an interesting aspect as well. Now, a couple of things about developments over time. There isn't much, meaning that the system basically remained in place unchanged over time, really until the late Safavid period in its essentials. You know, hosting, carbonating, impressing, and I haven't talked about that, but that's an important part, the istiqbal, as it was called, the reception, both in these provincial towns where hundreds of people would come out, even thousands sometimes, dancing and making music and shooting rifles in the air and engage in jaridbazi, you know, hunting, not hunting, but, you know, riding on horses and throwing spears and so forth. Very colorful and very noisy. And there, too, the villagers were oftentimes forced to come out. And, of course, foreign visitors were mightily impressed with this ostentatious reception. So all that basically remained unchanged. But we do see a couple of things change over time. First of all, in the late Safavid period, we have clearly diminished generosity. The per diem system goes down. There is more temporizing, you know, postponement of payment, late payment of the tayin, of the per diem, partial treatment, lots of back and forth, acrimonious treatment, acrimonious disputes between the foreigners who claim more than they get. Sometimes they don't get anything. And it's all, I think, a sign, a manifestation of a deepening financial crisis in the Iranian state, in conjunction, I think, with growing corruption, which is itself a function of a weakening central state. But that's more speculative than I can demonstrate it with evidence. And then in the 19th century, again, mostly unchanged, but the whole institution become, slightly more formalized. We have the Treaty of Turkmenchay of 1828, which, of course, ends the Second War with the Russians. And that treaty, is the first example, to my knowledge, where there are fairly detailed instructions about mehmandari, jurisdiction, provisions, ceremonies, the type of ceremony, number of soldiers involved, and so forth. So more formalized and more institutionalized, perhaps a sign of, you know, a diplomatic system that becomes more internalized, internationalized, and thereby more institutionalized and formalized. We also have, and I bring this out in, you know, in a page or so, very interesting case study in British Iranian relation in the 19th century. Of course, we have a lot of documentation about that in both cases, whereby the British lavish mehmandari, and the term is actually mentioned on, for example, the first Iranian envoy to Britain, Abul Hasan Ilchi. Sir Gore Ousley is assigned to him, man with great experience by this time, great experience in Iran, as his official mehmandar. James Bailey, who is also a man who is quite familiar with Iran by this time, serves as the mehmandar of the three Persian princes who come to make their case in Britain. And then we have the issue of Herat, the crisis of Herat, 1838, when there is also a crisis in mehmandari, because Ajudan Bashi comes to London to congratulate King Victoria with her accession. And then the British grumble because they have spent so much money on previous visits by Iranians, including mehmandari, Iranian style, that they now say, well, you know, we should make exceptions for Iranians. We should sort of institute modern protocol and do away with all this lavishness in response to Iranian customs. But the status quo is kind of restored with the Treaty of Paris in 1857, which ends this crisis anyway. And then, you know, again, sporadic examples of mehmandari, really until World War I, you know, a couple of Dutch envoys and ministers appointed to Tehran before full ambassadors are appointed, with mehmandars waiting for them in Anzali. Of course, they take the Russian route for the most part. There's an example of Wilhelm Litten, German consul at Tabriz, same thing, 1914. He mentions that Armenians involved and so forth. And then the whole thing kind of fades. In other words, it's not clear what its fate is, whether it's officially abolished under Reza Shah, or whether it simply fades, also under Reza Shah, presumably. I haven't found any information about that. And it's perhaps a task for future historians to dig into that, because, of course, articles or scholarship in general, of course, is supposed to elicit more questions and better answers in the future. So that's a task for my colleagues in the future. Of course, all idea, and I'd like to finish with that, is that mehmandari as a concept is still around. First of all, the importance of receiving the mehman with mehman nawazi, courting the visitor, but also, of course, the modern Islamic Republic, visitors, journalists, they're received piecemeal, but they're also given minders right away who, fulfill that, again, the double function of being mehmandar and also the person who controls their movements and reports directly to the authorities about, their goals and objectives and activities. So I'd like to end with that one. I'm not sure how long I've spoken, a little over half an hour. So I invite comments and questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's really interesting to make that link through to the present day and to see how these kinds of practices do continue within the Islamic Republic and other states, I guess, where the same sort of thing happens, where you get a minder and you're being watched. So, but overall, thank you for an absolutely wonderful talk, Rudy. And that gave us a really good sense of what's been going on and lots now to discuss and talk about. And we're already getting some questions through for you. So do if you're watching, do go down to that Q&A box at the bottom and type in your question if you have a question for Rudy, and we'll get through hopefully as many as we can. We've got plenty of time for further discussion. That was I really enjoyed that talk. Thank you.
My pleasure.
We've got some questions already. When was the exchange of official ambassadors initiated during the period you're covering, and were they included in mehmandari circles, is our first question.
Well, as I said, the origins of the office are fuzzy and poorly documented. So I can't pinpoint anything. Mm. All I can say is that it's a continuum, clearly, with, intermittent and very sporadic examples that allow one to at least trace a certain development over time. It existed in the Timurid period. I've tried to find documentation, and maybe I've overlooked things. But I haven't found anything for, previous Iranian or Turco-Mongol regimes, including the Mongols themselves, much less for the period before that. Again, a snippet of information about the Sasanians, the Mamluks, I think I mentioned, with the same term, which indicates an Iranian origin, which then makes one think that it moved from east to west, right? That it has an Iranian, an Eastern Islamic, even though it's pre-Islamic, clearly pre-Islamic in its origin, because it did exist under the Achaemenids, but again, without any kind of detailed information other than, taking care of foreign visitors, presumably in the same way. But so again, to summarize the answer to the question, it's impossible, at least at this point in time, to pinpoint anything in terms of where it comes from and how it evolves over time, other than in very broad strokes.
Mm, yeah. It sounds like, you're having to really piece together this puzzle and look in lots of different places to,
sure,
to create your
picture. Yeah, it took me years. I mean, just by every time I read something and remotely resembling mehmandari, or literally, a note card, and then it build up on over time, you have 60 note cards and you have the beginning of an article, right?
Yes.
Something like that.
Yeah. I'm going to take the sort of liberty of being the sort of the chair, and I'll actually at that point ask my own question, because I think it fits well there. So what kind of archives, like where were you getting your information from, and what are
Well, the way I always work, I mean, I'm an omnivore. I just ransack everything that's available, the archives. I mean, the Dutch archives, the French archives, the British archives, well, for modern times, German archives. I've worked in Berlin. Of course, there are no Iranian archives for the Safavid period, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, we're limited to the chronicles. And the chronicles are very informative about certain things, but not about this type of thing necessarily. There's mm-hmm. actually one source, I must admit, to my great chagrin and regret, that I overlooked and it just came to my attention. And that is, where is it? Oh, it's right here. Just a second. You know, it's this wonderful manual that I should have looked at earlier, the Ruzat al-Anwar Abbasi by Mullah Muhammad Baqir Sabzawari. Okay. It's kind of a mirror of princes, a belated mirror of princes manual. And it talks at the very last, which is why it eluded me, about diplomacy. And it admits, it just lays out the simple fact that diplomacy is all about gathering intelligence. And that, you know, when the Shah sends envoys to foreign countries, he should make sure to get reports, and preferably more than one report, so we can compare and contrast, try to find as much information as possible about foreign lands. And it's also the case that we should, you know, monitor these foreign visitors to see what they're up to. So it's very explicit. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to put that into my article, because it would have been a great addition in a way, because it doesn't get more explicit than that in some ways. But it also makes sense, of course. It's merely explicating something that is implicitly very obvious.
Yes.
But it's a Persian source, and it's a rare one in that sense.
Yeah. I guess that always happens. We find more evidence kind of after we've finished a piece of work.
Sure.
Okay, another comment and question. Someone thanking you for the wonderful talk. The Ottomans, they say, definitely did have a similar office. Mm-hmm. They had to pay the expenses of large Safavid embassies.
Yes.
And Sinem Akçak claims that Safavids, due to their lower power, did not receive any gifts in these embassies, but this questioner says they don't think that's accurate. Well, they're also asking about hostage taking, but yeah.
Right. Well, hostage taking was, of course, you know, very common and rife, and was even done by the Ottomans of Safavids, not to the point of killing them, but basically make a point, you know, we have the upper hand. There's, of course, a bit of a debate has been unleashed about this sort of inherent Ottoman superiority, behaving as such, considering themselves vastly superior to these, you know, lowly Safavids, you know, in terms of military might and royal splendor and so forth. But I'm not quite, and it's expressed sometimes in a bit of a spat in terms of value of gifts, regalia, and so forth. And you could probably say that the Safavids more lavish in bringing gifts to Istanbul than vice versa. Certainly what has survived at the Topkapi speaks to that.
Yes.
But you could also say that, you know, it merely brings out the fact that Iran is more generous. I don't know. But it's a bit of an unresolved issue, I think.
Okay.
Because there's also documentation that the Safavids pushed back and called it, you know, the Ottomans just, you know, irredeemable heretics, for example. That's, of course, sort of a back and forth between the two. But it is definitely true that the Ottomans tried to sort of pull rank over the Safavids.
Okay. And they also ask, who are the envoys?
Well, that's a generic question that I find very hard to answer, because it all depends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, in the Russian case, we have official ilchis, as they're called, and then you have sort of common, basically glorified merchants, you know, bring a lot of merchandise hoping to make money, but also bring a message from the Tsar. You know, Russia was also, of course, an empire in the making. It was in some ways less sophisticated at the time, precisely because it was in development. But you do have already this sort of calibration between high level and mid level ones. And it's the same with the Safavids, and it's the same with foreigners, of course. You know, delegations sent by, say, the East India companies, both the English and the Dutch, were inherently seen as less important and less grand certainly from the Dutch side, because they represent a republic. Go figure, a republic. What does that mean? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, a bunch of merchants ruling a country. Can we take that seriously? So that's reflected to some extent in long waiting periods and somewhat dismissive behavior and so forth, as opposed to, you know, the French king sending his envoys. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the French envoys get treated royally. They suffer the same kind of inherent, you know, temporization and letting people wait interminably in order to show the importance of the Shah and so forth. Mm-hmm. Endless negotiations about protocol. You see this with the Russians, it's a very interesting development, you know, just mounting and dismounting. Mm-hmm. You know, the Russians were as big as the Safavids on this idea that the envoy representing the Tsar should not be the first to dismount from his horse, right? Because that's humiliating yourself. But of mm-hmm. course, that was a huge clash. So sometimes, you know, there are examples of Russian envoys being pulled off their horses by the Safavids and then creating this huge diplomatic crisis and yes. endless kahar. You know, yes. this, you know, grudges being yes. played out between the two and standoffs. So it's hard to answer the question of who were the representatives because, you know, there's a whole spectrum involved.
Okay. Here's quite a different question. It's quite interesting. I'm asking about whether we have any evidence or know about similar kinds of reporting of mehmandari among sort of normal kind of non-elite people of different sorts of economic and social status?
Well, not on the part of the Iranians, because mm-hmm. again, you know, it's this eternal lament, and I won't go into it because it's quite boring by now that, you know, we don't have the sources that point to ordinary people, women, peasants, you know, and you name them, workers. Yes. You know, you get those, that information, with a rare exception, of course, again, from the Western sources, read against the grain, if you can. But, you know, they mostly come out, ordinary people, as victims of the whole system, as I think I pointed out.
Yes,
they bore the brunt. They bore the burden, you know, of having to collect all this material, all these provisions, all these victuals. There's actually an interesting example. There's an Ottoman delegation, I think in the early 19th century. Mm-hmm. It may actually be the delegation that ends up furnishing the first official Ottoman ambassador in Iran. And they clearly perceive at the border, Bazargan, you know, the point of the frontier town between the two realms, how the local people are abused and they suffer, you know, the bastinado.
Yes.
You know, and dramatic physical punishment for not paying up. And they decide to completely forego their mehmandari, meaning their tayin, their daily allowance, because they take pity on the people. But that's the only example where you have this direct connection. But the fact that it's ordinary people who suffer, that yes. is crystal clear from many sources yes. in great detail, as I point out in the article.
Yeah. And on that note, someone has just asked, could you remind our listeners, viewers, exactly where they can find the article? I think you said it was in Iran.
Well, it's in Iran. It's a first view article.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have page numbers attached to it, but it came out, I think, exactly a month ago.
Okay.
So if you look up Iran, you know, the British Journal of Persian Studies, you will find it.
Yeah. Okay.
On the first view.
Fantastic.
Or advanced articles. I know what the terminology
yes,
is.
Yes, it should be just up online, shouldn't
right.
it?
Right.
Thank you. Thanks for that reminder. Sure. Let's see. So you used a word mehmandar, and then they say in Urdu, we say, I actually don't speak Urdu, so I'm going to mispronounce this from an English transliteration. Maizban, who is the person who does the mehmandari. And they're right. just asking if there's any similar term in Persian.
Yeah, well, there's, of course, the term mizban, which is probably the same word.
Oh, yes, that's true, mizban.
Yeah,
yes.
It must be the mizban, okay. which yeah. is never, to my knowledge at least, in my sources, never used interchangeably with the mehmandar.
So mehmandar
but it is
a specific...
of course, kind of a cognate term, right? It's the table host, if you want to call it that, something like that.
Yeah.
So that would make sense that it becomes drifts off into Urdu, which I don't read and I haven't consulted their sources. Yes. But that would make some sense as kind of a derivative.
Yeah. Okay. Someone's asking, do we have accounts from the travelers describing their experience of being hosted?
Absolutely.
I presume that's
that's in the article. Yes. I mean, I gave a synopsis of the article. The article is 18 pages.
Yes.
Which means 36 columns.
They're asking, were they aware that they were being monitored?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pietro della Valle has an extensive description about that. So that every day the guy came around to pepper with more questions. The other thing is they couldn't move once they were in the capital without being accompanied by the Mehmandar Borshi. So their movements were, I mean, monitored in great detail. They were kind of quarantined.
Yes.
Now, again, there was nothing uniquely Iranian about that, because we have this in Venice and other European countries. It's kind of inherent, you know, you have a foreign visitor and of course you want to find out what he's up to, right? And who he's talking to while in being in the capital. This becomes a huge issue, for example, with Artemiev Volinsky, who was a major Russian envoy in 1717-18, comes to Isfahan. By this time, it's clear that Peter the Great is engaged in expansionist project, you know. Shortly thereafter, he moves into northern Iran, takes Gilan and so forth. So this is just a spying operation. The Iranians are fully aware of him. I mean, they can't just throw him out and treat him horribly, because they have to deal with an increasingly powerful force on the horizon, the Russians. But they do everything to find out what he's up to. And they suspect him of being just a spy. And he is. It's very clear from the Russian sources. He had detailed instructions to surveil and report on, you know, access routes and topography and environmental issues and population density and the rest of it. So, you know, this wasn't a, you know, this wasn't a conspiracy. This was true. And of course, you know, in general, you know, why, again, travel 3,000 miles? There were a lot of people who did that, you know. Because there was, this is also the beginning of the age of discovery and enlightenment. Yes. So it was not, it wasn't all nefarious, but official diplomacy was inherently about gathering intelligence. Why send out someone at great cost to figure out what's going on at the other side of the world?
Yeah.
Right.
This is an interesting question. Someone's asking, do we know like the detail of how the visitor makes contact with the Mehmandar? So do they have to stay at the border? At a border point, and then
they're typically waiting for them. They're waiting for them. There's a very calibrated, finely calibrated system of reporting, and you know, even though we have no information about how that works, just as we don't have real inside information about spying and its nature, we just have examples of people who are clearly spies, especially Ottoman Empire, not so much Iran. But to come back to the question, they typically, the foreign visitors was typically. You know, or the Mehmandar was awaiting the arrival of the foreign visitor at the border town. So it was highly institutionalized in that way. In Anzali in later times, when the Russian route became the common one, so they were standing at the docks, you know, waiting for the guy and his entourage to show up.
Let's see. So I suppose you've sort of touched on this. I mean, the question maybe was written a little while ago now, but just thinking about the examples of a mehman losing their privilege or being a sort of a persona non grata because of their behavior.
Yeah, I don't have clear examples of that. I do have, if I remember correctly, a passage where which flows out of this notion that it's a position that's put up at auction for to the highest bidder because it was so lucrative, right? And that means great competition and fistfights break out between various contenders, right? I want the job. No, I want the job, right? So that speaks to the kind of instability of the office in a way, and the fact that even though it's institutionalized as such, there is no specific person attached to it. But I haven't seen any examples of people, someone being thrown out for corruption or for more for egregious abuse of the system, losing his job or even his head. I don't remember seeing any examples of that.
And the visitors themselves don't get sort of deported, as it were?
No, no, because I think that's kind of the code of honor that comes with, you know, Ta'aruf and Mehman Nawazi. You know, maybe they're actually foreigners who say that foreigners are allowed certain leeway, not allowed to Iranians. They gallop their horses on the Maidan in Isfahan, something that would be punished by death by Shah Abbas if an Iranian did that. So they get a lot of, and it's still true, of course, as a foreigner, you get certain privileges not accorded to Iranians. And that's in part because the foreigner is unaware of Iranian code. So he's kind of a dummy. So we let him do things and we smile and we snicker, you know, because, you know, it takes too long to educate him in our refined way, so to speak. But there is also, you know, there is a, I think it's kind of an inherent Iranian, I hate to put the word deference, but allowing him more rights, and there's a certain ihtiram, a certain honor accorded to foreigners that still exists in some ways. Right? So I think that goes in it as well, even though it's kind of hard to extract and elaborate on, because, you know, one should also always be careful with cultural statements. But I think it's inherently part of it, quite frankly.
I have a wonderful question now from someone who is has as their family name Mehmandar. And they ask, can they say that they are following in a line of sort of old original Mehmandars? I suppose the name
Mehmandar. Well, possibly. I would, by all means, I would, you know, create a Instagram page boasting that, you know, we are from a long line of Mehmandars. And that's probably true, but, you know, who knows?
I don't know.
Yeah, without documentation, in other
words. But how fun that we have a Mehmandar with us this evening.
That is, that's wonderful.
Let's see. Just trying to see. It's just someone, I mean, you mentioned that they are all he's, all of these actors. Are there any females in any of these?
No, there were females in the estiqbal, you know, the welcoming parties. You know, men and women come out and they dance and make a lot of noise with instruments and so forth, but not in the actual practicality of Mehmandari. I haven't seen any example.
And in this period, no one, no women were going to Persia from
Well, there's of course the infamous, the famous, infamous slash infamous example of Marie Petit, who is this woman who in the 1710s is part of a you know, a French expedition, and then takes over when the male representative dies, and then creates quite a spectacle in Iran. But that's the exception that proves the rule. As far as I know. No.
Gosh, there's so there's lots of questions. Let's see. Some of them are comments, which I can share with you later, because it's a bit difficult to. We're nearly out of time. Oh, someone's asked, would you say that the absence of permanent embassies hurt the Safavids in any way?
Well, yeah, of course. You know, because embassies means you have a standing source of information, a daily source of information spread out over time. You see this in the Ottoman Empire too. The French and the Dutch, and then later the English, have standing representation in Istanbul, and they produce a never-ending flow of information about the workings of the Ottoman system. The Ottomans work with ad hoc representation, send an embassy for the issue at hand. And, you know, they deal with it and they solve it, hopefully, and then they come back. So you get a little burst of information, but nothing systemic over time. So inherently, yes, absolutely.
And I guess I think I'm sorry that I didn't get through everybody's questions, but I can share them with Rudy, and you can always be in discussion subsequently. So final question that I can cover within the time slot, it would be just asking about if you know how similar or different this system was to what might have been going on within the Mughal Empire.
Very little, almost no information, I must admit. I haven't really looked into the Mughal, meaning the Persian mostly Persian language sources of the movie.
Yes.
A little bit. I haven't found anything other than a few snippets, the ahadi, you know, the term mm-hmm. used mostly for the equivalent of the mehmandar in mm-hmm. the Mughal period, but nothing beyond that. I think I even wrote to a Mughal specialist colleague, didn't get anything out of that. So, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist, yes. really,
yes.
because the article was already 15,000 words.
Mm.
And, you know, it's a first intervention.
Yeah.
And as always, I invite people to come complete and yeah. contest
yes.
and push the our knowledge beyond what I represent.
Yes. Well, it's represent. It's a wonderful start in this very understudied topic, and it's bringing up,
sure.
I mean, more questions are still coming in, thinking about Tar sure. Roth and,
right.
and other sorts of the use of Mehmandari in other places. But I think
right.
That we will probably have to end it there, but I'm sure people can also just be in touch with you, and I'll share the questions
sure.
With you, Rudy. I've just got from Maria, the very efficient organizer, will be sharing the link to the paper
excellent.
With everyone
excellent.
Now.
Sure.
So hopefully everyone will we're in the chat, I suppose she can share that with everybody so everyone can see that. And any details, I think someone was asking about the Persian language book that you were referring to, Rudy. Well, when that goes up on the YouTube, you can go back and pause.
Sure,
and that will all be visible to anyone who's right. more interested in finding out about that.
Okay.
But yeah, thank you ever so much for sharing this really interesting research with us and for giving us your time. And thank you to everyone who joined us and asked such interesting questions.
My pleasure. It was wonderful. I really enjoyed it myself.
Yeah.
So.
And it's my only regret that on Zoom through this medium, I can't be offering hospitality and you're bringing out
okay.
the fruit and
sure.
the tea to
it
everyone.
Nice to have a reception afterwards.
Exactly. Right. I recommend yes. that everyone go and have some nice tea and sweets in honor of the topic
sure.
that we've just been discussing. And I hope everyone
excellent.
Has a great day. And thank
right.
you again very, very
okay.
much, Rudy.
Thank you so much for inviting
thank
me.
You. Okay,
right.
thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.